Knives have always been a part of your life, whether it was in the field, on a deployment, or just something you took pride in using. But now injuries, arthritis, or just years of wear and tear make using them harder than it used to be. Now, what if there was a way to get that control back, to use a blade with confidence again? Today's guest, Doug Katz, is a West Point grad, disabled Army veteran, and an adaptive product innovator who is revolutionizing the way we use knives. His creation, the Nulu knife, is helping people of all abilities cook safely and effectively. So stick around, because this conversation isn't just about a knife. It's about regaining independence, dignity, and the ability to keep doing what you love. But before we dive in, head on over to driveonpodcast.com/subscribe to get my top five favorite episodes sent straight to your inbox. And not only that, you'll get updated anytime a new episode is released, so you're always in the know. Let's get into it. Doug, I want to welcome you to the show. Really glad to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start with, maybe if you could just share a little bit about your background, your time in the military,
sure.
That type of thing, just to, I always like to start it off with stuff like that, just to kind of give people an idea of who they're talking to and,
sure.
A little bit about who you are first, and then we'll get into, kind of.
You want the origin story before the heroic stuff.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, exactly.
So I was actually the first in the military from my family. I grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And, it's funny. I look back on why did I go into the military? And it's hard, right? You look back, you're a different person when you're 18. But it was the Reagan era, the time of Red Dawn, like all that kind of stuff, right? So, I think I really felt that calling. I wanted to be sort of in the thick of it. My first goal, I wanted to be a Marine. And I had an ROTC scholarship for that. And then I had an awesome guidance counselor who basically was like, hey, you know about the academies? I knew nothing about them. So I actually still was on that Marine. I wanted to, go that way. I went to the Naval Academy's summer session and was lucky enough to not get my appointment there from my senator or congressman. They appointed me to go to West Point, where I never visited. So my first experience at West Point was because I flew there alone, actually. It was kind of funny. And to this day, there's a gentleman, my classmate, who we didn't know each other. Like, they had an area where we were all eating dinner. Then people, his parents weren't dropping him off. And he was a guy I had dinner with that night before we went in, and we were both cured chillas. And I still, to this day, at every reunion, we sit down and have a drink. But so went to West Point from 89 to 93. Had a really great experience there. I joke, there's a way that they grade cadets coming in, right? They look at your sports and your academics and your other stuff. And I was a decent candidate, but I was to the bottom of what they call a whole candidate score, right? They look and they say, here's the 1,100 people or whatever going into the class of 93. We're likely going to lose 30%. And if we rank them now, here's the likely 30%. I was square in that group that dropped out. But I took to it like a fish in water, right? They sometimes call people gray hogs who like the lifestyle there because we all wear gray. But I had a great experience there, and it really changed me. And that's why I wanted to go into depth, is it was that point to say, wow, this is the right culture for me to be in. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about, and I think part of it is athletics, right? I think athletes love the military, especially Army and Marines, because it feels like you're on a team again. So I had a great experience there, went to the 4th ID afterward in an artillery role. I was an artillery officer, and it's funny. I had a good West Point career, so I was rated high in my branch and high in my class when I graduated, which ended up being a disadvantage, because the way it works with that, you pick your post, right, and you go there, but then they give the choice to the post on how you get placed, and I got stuck at like a division level artillery role. Which now I look back and say it was great. Back then, didn't love it so much. But did my 5 years in the artillery. Had a really great diverse career, which I think patterns on my civilian career. And the reason I wanted to talk a little bit about how I got placed and where I got placed was, it all provides a perspective, right? The typical artillery career, you go fire support and then fire direction or on the gun line or vice versa. I was at like a division level, then I was a fire support officer, and then I was an intelligence officer. So it was a really unique artillery, because artillery is the only one who have their own intelligence officers. But it gave me a different view of how I look at like business when I was an entrepreneur. I think more about what the enemy's doing, right? I plan differently. So had a great career. Did go into the reserves. Like I was ready to get out when I got out. And for me, I think it was a mistake in retrospect. I really should have given it a better look. But it was in the years of a drawdown, right? 98. I got in 93, 98. Great economy, drawdown. Many of my classmates didn't serve their full five, but didn't do it in a way that was, you know, cheating the taxpayer. Like the Army said, do you want to get out? And people got out. So yeah. I did my full five and then moved, transitioned to the civilian one.
Okay. Okay. And so what kind of inspired you to do what you're doing now, as far as we were talking in the intro a little bit about the knives that you create are, you know, more adaptive for, you know, folks with disabilities and that type of thing?
It's interesting because it wasn't planned. And I think that is, it's something that I think has been hard for me. And it's, I think it's hard for a lot of military guys to sort of let things happen sometimes organically and work from there. So I had always been sort of a corporate guy, mostly in the service part of, like I was in lending for 25 years. I was in the telecom industry, but I was on the marketing side. I was on the product side. I mean, I sold the product, but it wasn't design and manufacture. And so I never really had that in me, right? I had convinced myself I was not mechanical, right? When I went to West Point, every individual has to have the equivalent to a minor in engineering. If you don't major in engineering, you have to have the equivalent to a minor. I took systems engineering, which jokingly was called engineering for people who don't like math. and again, another one of my regrets, because what I found when I relocated at one point was I like making. I like the physical process of creating something. And the knife was 100% accidental. And I was fortunate in that my wife knows me very well and had gotten me a knife. And it's funny, I keep it under my desk here. And it got me a really nice craft knife from a guy, is, you know, and he, this is a guy who taught me, made this, and he taught class too. So my wife got me the class, and I made a couple four or five knives with this guy. And when we moved, one of the things was, I'm like, Tim, you can have everything you want with the house, just I would like a shop where I could set up a forge. So I started doing that, and my intent was great retirement plan, right? Work until I don't work anymore, and then maybe make knives and sharpen knives. I've learned that I'm a maker, but I'm not an artisan. Like, yeah. I can make knives that people like, but I usually gift them. What I found was my problem solving and making sort of came together. And for me, I was having major issues at that point. I've got some tennis elbow that comes back now and again. I have some things from the military and my time playing rugby and all the, you know, you do stuff. And, you know, to some degree, the scars and the injuries are sort of the map of having a full life.
Right.
But it's something, right? Right. I love to cook, yeah. And I couldn't cook. This was right before they completely rebuilt my shoulder. As the doctor, who was another West Point guy, said, you got everything. Like, you got, you know, labrum, rotator cuff, bicep. I got everything. But before that, I was having some real issues. I couldn't swing a hammer to make a knife. I couldn't cook in the kitchen the same way. And I was like, and of course, me, instead of going, well, I wonder if I can go on Amazon and find something. I went out in the garage and I was just kind of hanging out. And the circular shape kind of kept coming to me. I'd been playing, like I made like a novelty pizza cutter one day for my wife. And it was like the Pizza Slayer. And it was sort of this half moon blade, sort of a modified Ulu. And I was like, well, wait a minute. Why does it work? It's a circular thing. And I started putting on the problem solving hat. And that's when this came about. And the interesting part is the knife is the on-ramp. But what my partners and I, many of whom are veterans, figured out was the way that society looks at disability is very, very interesting, right? It's sort of a binary, able or disabled. But then you'll see a disabled vet and you're like, oh, you're disabled. Then, yeah. But they won't call themselves disabled, right? So
right.
It occurred to us, especially when we were trying to figure out the market, right? Because we would like to raise money and people are, you know, disabled people. It's a small market. Not when you approach it. And it was funny. You're going to probably nod when I describe what our approach is, but it was sort of a military approach. What we said was, wait a minute, are we looking at this the right way? Disability is a function of symptomatic manifestation that disallows you to do certain tasks.
Okay.
So you could argue for certain tasks in the kitchen, children are disabled. Mm-hmm. Their strength, dexterity, and coordination are lesser than an adult would have the ability to do it without any impairment. So we actually are trying to approach it from a scale, and we call it the ability curve, that looks at things from the ability, from the perspective of what's the task, condition, and standards. Probably sounds familiar if you've been in the military, right? And if you cannot perform that at the highest level, then you're disabled. You may be degraded, but you still can't do it at the level that somebody who isn't is.
Sure.
And that's sort of our approach to this is to say adaptive design is smart design. And most people, and with something like a knife, where, you know, I know when I put this up there, like, this is a cool knife, right? It's sort mm-hmm. of got that masculine, you know, hey, this is something I could be on the frontier of the West and defended myself. But, and that's hard to break, right? People have this paradigm. This is what a knife should look like. One of the people we talked to said, I want to feel like a chef. Well, that's performative. It, you know, it, for me, it's how can I make a great meal that afterward we can have a glass of wine and drink and have a good meal. And that's what's important. So
yeah.
We're trying to kind of take that approach. And we've got some other product that we're approaching from that perspective. So Nulu is the first, hopefully, in a whole portfolio of products that we're trying to bring smart adaptive design. And it's funny, right? Because the military is great on adaption, right? Is how do you bring technology and lighter and all this kind of stuff, but you don't look at it the same way, right? All of a sudden, if you're disabled, you're less of a person. And by approaching it and embracing an adaptive approach, I am admitting then that I am lesser than I was, whatever, right? I think I read an article once that said, after a certain age, when you look in the mirror, it surprises you because in your brain, and I think it's almost like in the Matrix, right? The where he has hair in the Matrix, but doesn't, right? That's what you expect yourself to look like. Well, people expect themselves to look at like 30 or 35. Like there's some number where like basically your brain says, I'm not going to deal with this anymore. I think disability is the same way, right? People look at it and they're like, if I admit it, then I admit that I'm going down a road of losing more and more things that I can do. Right. As opposed to saying, and there's been a lot written about like lifespan and then life, like what your life is during that lifespan. And I've been really good about extending life into our 80s, but really bad about extending quality of life into our 80s. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're kind of looking is to say anybody who's degrading, and we all go there, father time wins 100% of the time. And going there in a smart way. And what we really do think is if you can get a big enough group of the population, especially maybe someone who gifts it to a grandparent or gifts it to, like I'm a sandwich generation person, right? Like I've got elder parents and I've got kids who are of, you know, teens up into their 20s. But when my dad was alive, when he was living alone, I would have gifted this to him, right? I would have sent him one and say, hey, this should help you with your cooking.
Yeah.
What we're hearing from a lot of people is like, maybe I'll buy one for myself as well. And that's where we think we're onto something with changing the dialogue of ability, right? It shouldn't be disability. It's just, you're on an ability scale.
Yeah.
That's why we call it the ability curve. So that's kind of where we've gone with it.
I like the way you frame that too, because I'm thinking about people that I know who maybe have some sort of disability, and there's things that they used to be able to do when they were younger, like all of us, as you said,
like,
father
like
time
everything.
Wins, you know, like anything, right? You know, when I was 18, I could do a hell of a lot more than I could do now, as far as, you know, I was more flexible. I was able to, you know, run faster. I was able to lift, you know, heavier things and all those things because, well, I was young and my body was still, you know, willing to accept the fact that I was going to punish it. And it's not so much anymore, you know?
Listen, but, you know, if you look, and it's funny, as you were talking, in my brain, I'm thinking, Cialis and those are adaptive, right? Like,
sure.
Can't do anything the same way. It's different. It's pharmaceutical. But, boy, it's amazing how when people value what they're losing, how they'll look and be like, hey, you know what? I'm going to make what decisions I need to.
Right.
I don't think we do that in everyday life. So, you know.
Yeah, it's you're right. You know, I have hearing loss.
By the way, I wasn't intimating that for some reason you needed either one of those.
No. I understand.
It's more a matter of like, well, it just occurred to me, you know, that's one thing that you see on TV all the time. Hey, I can't do it the way I used to.
And people talk about it too, like it's a no big thing. Like, of course I'm going to take it. Like,
right.
Like,
but then you try crazy to give not them to. An adaptive knife. You give them something that looks like a Klingon war knife and, you know, they're like, oh, I don't want to do that. I want to look like a chef. And it's like, okay, well, you know.
Well, you know, another thing too that I was about to say is, you know, like, I have hearing loss too from my time in the military, and I wear hearing aids, right? And there's like a stigma, like people are like, "Oh my God, hearing aids!" Oh,
I'm right there with you, brother.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I got these headphones on now, so it's like pumping right into my ears and noise canceling, so I can't hear anything else that's going on around me right now. So, as far as hearing goes, right now I'm good because it's pretty clear, but. You know, for day-to-day life, I need them. Like, days that I forget to put them in, and, like, my wife or my kids or someone are talking to me, especially if there's, like, background noise, like television's on or you're in a restaurant or something like that. I don't know what you guys are saying. Like, why are you whispering? And they're not whispering. It's me. You know, I'm the problem. But I wear those hearing aids so that I can do the things that I otherwise would be able to do had I not had this hearing loss. Be able to carry a conversation without getting frustrated.
Well, but
with the
so
people,
I would ask you though, if you're like, did you get yours to the VA?
Yeah.
Okay, so they're Bluetooth enabled.
Yep.
So it's interesting, right? When all of a sudden it becomes a greater functionality, like one of mine is not charging now, so I got to go hit the VA. But for me, it's like, okay, well, you know, it's helping me, but it's also replacing the need for any kind of earbud or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, I think it's layering features and benefit onto stuff where, you know, you embrace it more. Because where I'm at, like when I can't hear, it's really funny. My brain will fill in and I'll be like, why did you say that? And my kids are like, what? So, right. It's
because you can kind of read their lips too, right?
Yeah.
Like you start to learn how to do that. It's weird. I started doing that before, you know, I had the hearing aids. I just started reading lips and people are like, that's kind of freaky. Like you shouldn't be able to hear me. And I know you can't, but like, how did you know? Right.
Well, it's interesting. I was listening to a podcast the other day and it's completely off topic, but they were talking about how your brain adjusts with everything. They were talking about vision, but your brain will rewire and say, hey, you know what? I'm not getting it this way. So it's kind of interesting stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually had, you're right. The hearing aids I have now are Bluetooth enabled and they do have those extra features, but I did have an old school hearing aid too years ago when I got my first one.
Your ear like
Right. But it was basically just like a microphone and a speaker that goes in your ear. That it was that dumb technology. It didn't have any connectivity to anything. It was just that, right? But when I got the new ones, I was kind of giddy. To get them because I was like, this is so cool. It connects and you can listen to music or I could be sitting in bed, you know, like they have a little device that connects to the television that will stream the sound from the television straight to your hearing aids. I could be in bed. My wife could be sleeping. I could have the television on and she wouldn't even know, you know?
You know, and what's interesting is, and it's funny, as you were talking about hearing aids, what flashed in my head is Apple right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the newest AirBuds that they have. I'm an Android guy, so if I said it wrong, apologies to all the Apple people. But they're now making those hearing aids. And what's really interesting is that sometimes the source, I think, with adaptive design and adaptive technology, because there would be, old people are terrible about wearing hearing aids. Like you and I, younger, and the not having the hearing aids represents a lessening of an experience when you're out and about, where seniors, many tend to be insular already, so they can turn their TV up loud. They don't need the hearing aids. But then you have someone like Apple that comes on the scene, right? And they're like, hey, we're going to make your Apple ecosystem hearing aids.
Yeah.
And it's the greatest thing ever, right? So
sure.
I think as especially now when it's all, there's this tribalism and mm-hmm. you don't necessarily want your tribe to be the broken people. I'm finding a lot of innovation and optimism and all of that. And I think when we've got all these, you know, and this is kind of getting, you know, pie in the sky, but when we've sure. got all these issues, the one thing that really does unite us is we're all broken. Like, we're, you know, when you're in a certain age, man, like, you know, again, and the best people are the most broken because they've done the most.
Right.
And if we can at least agree on that, I think that some of the things that are around that, anything from design to the all the other services and stuff associated with that, isn't looked upon as extraneous.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're all going to be there. And that's kind of, we've been playing around with market messaging. That was one of them we batted around that isn't necessarily the one we're going to go with. But it's the reality, right? Like,
right.
if you don't need this tomorrow, I'll wait because you're going to need it. And,
yeah.
But I think it's good. I think it's good that there's more people having the dialogue on this podcast. I've been on a lot of others that are not specifically talking about adaptive and disability and all that kind of stuff. It's more about, and unfortunately, I think a lot of the disability focuses on the really high visibility stuff. And it should, MS, Parkinson's, all that on the research side. But what's interesting is like on arthritis, osteoarthritis, to my knowledge, there's not much you can do with it. Your cartilage goes bye-bye and yeah. that's it. Or other certain things, carpal tunnel. Yes, you can get surgery and all that, but there's really not research into saying, you know, how can we prevent it? Design is how you prevent it, right? Repetitive stress injuries, all those kind of things. So, you know, I wish that there was more dialogue in, oddly enough, one of my MS friends, one of my friends who has MS who we're talking to, mentioned this, and it's a brilliant, and I don't know if it's his, but he talked about the great impact of small improvements.
Mm.
And that everything doesn't have to be a home run and you can win a game on single. And
yeah.
I loved that because at a point where we were trying to find our voice as a company, that sort of became a good North Star. And it was a great way for us to look and say, wow, we can be the small improvement that has a major impact on somebody. And that's good enough, right? I don't mm-hmm. want to cure arthritis, but if I can make somebody able to embrace a low inflammation diet, right? Like they say, have a low inflammation diet. If you can't cook, it's pretty hard. I mean, you can spend a ton of money for specialized food delivery, but really the best way to control your diet, your weight, your inflammation is to cook for yourself. If
yeah.
you can't wield a knife, then you have very little control over that, or a caretaker has to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I learned on my caretaker time is it varies, but generally people who are cared for want to be cared for the least possible. They
yes.
would like to still feel valuable. They would still like to be able to do things. And I think that these type of things create the landscape for them to be able to do it, especially when you're talking now about more age in place. I don't know if any one of your viewers and listeners have priced out elder care lately. It ain't cheap. And if you've got a family member who is in relatively good shape, well, then why not create the landscape where or the environment where they're able to keep doing as much as they can?
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense too. Why wouldn't you create that sort of environment, right? Because to your point, I think everybody wants to still feel like they're 18, 19, 20 years old, where they can still do everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, as time goes on, there's fewer things that you can do because, you know, life happens, right? You get older, you know, you just wear down, right?
Well, and I think one thing I want to add to that, if I could, is I think there's a difference between unexpected disability,
mm-hmm.
you know, a accident, a diagnosis, and natural, right? Like,
yeah.
so having been through, my dad lived with us, and then her folks moved to our area, and he's in the hospital now, but he had lived with us for a while. Walkers, right? Like, for some reason, having somebody use a walker unless they're young and they just had surgery and they're like, I'm going to get rid of it. I think it represents another loss, right? So I think what happens with these people, and I see it myself, and when I say these people, me being one of that group, is every time you have to make a change in what was, you're more and more acknowledging the movement down that our life cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, I'm 54, and caretaking has really had a unique impact on my view of mortality, right? Like, you can't have this degree of closeness with people who die of old age and not look and say, hey, I'm in the same club. And I think that there's a very, very unhealthy view of healthy aging, and a degree that you want to always stay 35 instead of a very vibrant 54-year-old.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully that will change, right? I do some writing on the side, and I wrote an article the other day about, if you take the average lifespan, your life every year is about 1.3% of your life, which doesn't sound like a lot, but then you're like, wow, high school is 5%, right? Like, you start to look at these numbers. And I think when you look at it that way, it's an argument of optimization, right? You're looking and you're saying, okay. And when you get older, like I did some of the math, for someone who didn't like math, I'm mathy these days. When you're in your 50s, it's not 1.3%. It's, you know, 8.2 or whatever, right? It's a bigger number. Mm-hmm. And that's when I looked and I said, okay, if that's that big a bunch of chunk of what I got left, I better do everything that I can to make it the most exciting, you know, I should try and do everything I can. And if that requires the help of adaptive things, then I would be stupid to not take advantage of those to continue to live a pretty full life. So I think it's just a big change in a dialogue. And I think stuff with older folks is getting better.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's more of an understanding about that. Even AARP, for example, has their own accelerator and venture money that they spend on a debt. It's mostly tech, right? Like, I tried to get in on that, and I think it's kind of like, we want to make like all this big tech. Well, that's how that worked out. I'm just happy that people are starting to have that discussion.
Right.
Especially when you look at our community, because it's not just aging. It's aging that the what we're losing is accelerated by other issues that we had from serving the country.
Yeah, I was going to say it's accelerated aging. You know,
totally.
When you got the kids who were, you know, humping a, you know, 50-pound ruck for miles on end, and their back and their knees and their hips and, you know, all these other joints are starting to bother them when, you know, they look like they're 65 when they're really 25.
Well, I will say, though, they got over. When I went to Airborne in like 91, we still ran in boots. I don't think they do that anymore.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I think I owe my ankle and knee disability to the Army very much in terms of like, hey, well, and again, it's adaptive, right? Like, you look and you look at the Army 30 years ago. Hey, we're tough. We're going to run in boots. Wait a minute, this is costing us a shit ton of money later when these guys are disabled veterans, right? Like,
right.
So they adapted to say, hey, you know what? Let's spend a lot less money and be more mission ready. Like, it's still that kind of different thinking that I think makes sense.
You know, and one thing I learned too about the military is, you know, so after there's a combat death, the soldier, Marine, Airman, whoever was killed, they go through, they have they do the autopsy and all that stuff, but they record, like, where was this person injured? Were they shot in the chest? Were they shot in the arm? Were they shot in the leg? Shot in the face? Shot in the, you know, wherever? And they record that data not just for autopsy purposes. They record that data and they pass it along to the folks who do the development of all the body armor and things like that. And so it's a whole mindset of like, okay, well, if we have a whole bunch of injuries that are coming in a certain location on the body, well, maybe we need to do something to beef up the armor on that part of the body, right? And that, if you just look at the body armor from the time that you were in through the time to now, right? And how much that has evolved and changed over time. It's like night and day difference between what you guys had and what the soldiers are carrying around now and wearing now. Everything from the helmets, which, you know, you had helmets back then, but they're different. You know, they're lighter weight now.
First got in the Army.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You know, what's really funny is, though, it's then when you, like, lose... The number one thing people were bitching about when the steel pot went away was that you couldn't cook and shave in it. Like, because you can't do that in a Kevlar helmet, right? So, you know, things change. I think what's interesting is, there's no difference between an adaptive approach and just how things improve over time. I think that what holds it back is money, because when you say disabled, you immediately think wheelchair, right? Like, how do we show that someone's disabled? It's a placard or a license plate that's got a wheelchair, right? It's got probably the most monumental thing that people avoid, right? Like, there's people in wheelchairs, but it's the one thing that probably most changes your ability, your mobility, and things like that, right? All of a sudden, a lot of stuff changes. And I think that it's got to be more a talk about, one, the size of the market. Like, when we started sizing the market for, for an example, upper extremity, and we don't say disability. Again, we say weakness, coordination, and dexterity issues.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, stuff changes, right? So now, the reason we wanted to bring children into the discussion is, one, we're likely going to be launching a safe child's version because our geometry on the knife allows better force transfer, which means a kid can use it, but we want them to do it safely. Sure. But then when you start layering these different small markets where money gravitates to where the market is, right? You know, we're over 100 million in the number of people that could benefit from this knife, the people for whom the value proposition, the use case, and the problem that we solve is relevant.
Mm-hmm.
The more that I think there's that thinking, instead of everything mass market, right? Like right now, when you go to the events, my biggest problem when I'm trying to raise money isn't specifically on the disabled side. It's tech versus everyday stuff. Nobody wants to make products. If I had a new app, had some wide, like that's what the money moves to. And I think my challenge, I've been trying to find impact investors who look and say, I get this. Yeah. And oh, by the way, I get it because my arms hurt, my shoulder hurts, all this kind of stuff. So they're out there, but where a unicorn in the investment space usually means a company that's going to make a bajillion dollars, our unicorn is an impact investor that says, this is important. I've seen my parents and grandparents age. I may have a disabled family member. I support disabled vets. Our whole aspect with that is then obviously donate to nonprofits, but put your money where your mouth is and help us develop things that will create the mechanism, not just to give them money, but to also create the lifestyle that they should be leading.
Yeah. And the other thing too, and I think part of the reason why I brought up the whole issue with, the body armor and, kind of changing things over time is that, they're not making this body armor for the soldiers who are already shot.
Right.
They're making it for everybody else.
Yes.
Who is coming forward. So, when you're mentioning about how, you're making products for kids, it makes sense. If you have a product that can, in your case, a knife, right? It can cut things easier, more efficiently, does not require as much force that, you're pushing down, eventually, especially if you're, a professional chef or something, you're cooking often or even, just you're cooking for your family every night. You're doing that day after day after day after day, time after time, and it just wears down.
Stress.
Yeah, exactly. Why wouldn't you use something that reduces the likelihood that you're going to end up with that type of injury? At least if you are going to end up with that type of injury, maybe it'll be years and years down the road as opposed to more, something happening, more soon.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So push
that. Chefs are a tough bunch. Chefs are like, it's like, and I'll put it in military terminology. They're like the guys who like iron sights over everything else because they don't break, right? Like know, and I agree, right? Like, you should know how to use your irons. But, like, there's a chef once. A friend of mine had his chef buddy come over. They were both chefs, actually, to try out the knife. And we were talking. And I was showing him, like, well, here's a regular knife. And I was just using it like I would. And this is not the appropriate knife for it. So, and he's like, here's how you hold a knife if you're a chef. And mm-hmm. I'm like, well, that makes no sense. But time and time again, chefs that I talked to say, this took me a long time to learn. This is proper technique. And why are you messing with my proper technique? And I was like, but why do you have to learn technique to use something that should be an extension of your body?
Yeah.
Right? So it's like, great. Know how to use iron sights. It's great when the battery dies, but give me a red dot.
Right.
I want to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're running to in the food service industry is a lack of thinking like the military does. And until you said that, I didn't even make that connection.
Yeah.
But the food industry, I talked to an ortho, a friend of mine, and he's like, I love butchers and chefs and food prep people because I see a couple of them a week because of repetitive stress injuries. But you would be amazed. I've reached out to, I didn't know this until I got in the knife industry. For like restaurants and stuff, many of them subscribe. They don't own their own knives. They subscribe to a service that will
pick
up five knives and go sharpen them, and then they bring them five knives right the same day. And they're not the same knives. They're just getting the same type of knife that is sharpened and ready to use, and it takes that off their plate. The degree of non-response that we've gotten from the culinary industry, to include like influencers and all those kind of people. Restaurant owners, food prep company owner, and all of those, the ones they seem to get it. Cooking schools have been amazing. A lot of cooking schools have said, wow, we get it, because we might actually increase our market share because we could have specific cooking schools, cooking classes for people with problems, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, here's an anti-inflammatory cooking class, and you're going to use a knife, right? So they get it because they're looking and they're saying, I want to grow my market share. Everybody else is tough. Now, I will say a lot of voices in the knife industry have looked and said, cool knife, we totally get it. Our other big problem is manufacturing. It's a unique knife, and the way the knife industry is big automated systems to make a really particular kind of knife shape, linear. Yeah. I've had a lot of great help from people in the knife industry who, one, are great in respecting military, like they really want to help a disabled vet, but two, also are just super helpful. And that mm-hmm. industry gets it. And in fact, some of them have come up with some ergonomic knives, but this is where it failed. It looks ergonomic. It looks institutional. It looks so utilitarian that you're making a unnecessary compromise in the cool factor. You know, I keep forgetting to call him out when I'm on. He's a guy named Gordon Downey, who is amazing. He's been my friend for a long time, and we ended up on this together. He's not military, but he works great with my military partners. And thinks that way. He is an amazing designer. And what's super cool is he had spent his life prior working with me as a toy designer. And he's got just an eye. And my prototype versus what he has created are night and day. What keeps resonating with people we bring it to, one of my partners was at SHOT Show this past week, and he's a knife industry veteran, and he's like, people love it. They think it's really cool. It's the design part, right? It's the design part that is, does it work? And if you put it with a bunch of other knives, is that what you're going to pick up? Because it's appealing. It's sexy. It's got nice curves. And it's got, you know, this beautiful, I look at it like the Glock, right? Mm. The Glock is super utilitarian. I'm a revolver guy myself, but, and you hear people say, like, I love my, you know, Ruger Blackhawk that I'll bring to the range. And I love the old shooting feeling. But boy, when I go and that's my EDC, I'm going to carry a Glock because it just works.
Right.
And there's a beauty to its simplicity. The iPhone, right? Anything that you look at, there's sort of nice curves and a beauty to it. And what we're trying to do is also bring that to some of this design and bring a cool factor. So someone says, oh, no, I'm not disabled. That's a cool knife.
Yeah.
So that's where we're trying to bring that. And I think you can do a lot with handles and things like that. And our roadmap is heavily in more handle refinement and design and other uses like a sport version, a mini version, a kid's version.
Excellent. Yeah. And to your point, you know, for that look, you know, you look at, you know, sometimes you have somebody who's older, maybe, you know, with arthritis or something like that. And, you know, even tying their shoes is hard. So they have those like the Velcro shoes, right? That they
Oh, dude,
they
I'm
use.
A Skechers guy. Now, you know what? My family,
oh, for sure.
My family mourned the day that I started wearing Skechers. And I'm like, I don't care. Look, I like my feet not to hurt.
So that was actually the direction I was going with this, right? So you have that look, right? And I think you can put in your head the Velcro shoes that a lot, you know, maybe a grandparent or something like that might be wearing. And
or by the way, or the kid, not the disabled kid, the kid who just can't tie his shoes, right?
Like, sure, right.
Like it's just
so
like,
those are the two extremes. Like they get you when you're coming and going, I guess, you know. So like those are the two extremes of those types of shoes. None of them really look cool except for the, you know, maybe kid who has like the flashing lights on them or whatever. And
right.
those might look a little cool. But then Skechers comes along and they have those easy slip-on shoes and they don't look half bad either. You know,
right.
And so, I mean, some people hate them, but you know, whatever. I don't
right,
care.
So
I wear them too, you know.
Opinion question for you.
Yeah.
Like, I've had people criticize my Skechers when they're in Crocs.
Sure. I agree. 100%.
Right?
I think Crocs are the ugliest thing on the face of the planet.
I own Crocs
actually,
too. But, you know, I'm equal opportunity ugly.
You're equal opportunity ugly. I won't go into it because I know people love their Crocs, but I don't like them. I don't, whatever.
Well, but you know what's funny is Crocs are a great example of a hyper customizable, comfortable, right? Like,
yeah,
you can put the things in it where kids can customize it. They're easy in and out. Like, you look and you like, it was brilliant because they said this has such a good use case that people are not going to care. And
yeah.
They don't. And what was really funny is Crocs went out of style and I still wore mine. I'm like, I don't care. Like, at this point, you know, look at the facial hair. I really don't care. Then they came back in style, and they've been hitting hard for a while, right? Like,
right.
You know.
I see people at the gym wearing them. Like, they're on, like, the stair climber wearing Crocs, and they flip them into sport mode or whatever, and they're wearing those. I'm like, you don't have something a little safer to wear on these things? Like,
you know, it does make me wonder, like, could you super glue, like, an orthotic in a pair of Crocs and, like, make super Crocs? I might, that, this might have to be my weekend project.
I see the wheels turning. It's awesome. But, you know, all of this stuff here, so I think what we're talking about, just to boil this whole conversation down to kind of like the root of what we're talking about here is, look, we all have different levels of ability, right? Let's take disability off the table right now. We have different levels of ability. Like you said, there's a curve of, uh-huh. You know, I totally can do something and I'm the best in the world at it. And then I've never done this before. I don't know what I'm doing. And there's everything in between, right? And so most of us probably fall more on, you know, in the middle somewhere,
right.
But then like any bell curve, you're going to have people over on that, I can't do this for whatever reason. Maybe I'm not strong enough. Maybe I have joint issues. Maybe I have, you know, a missing limb or something like that. And I need something that makes it easier, you know, to be able to do that. So what, you know,
right.
Like I can't walk, you know, 20-mile round trip to go to work. If, you know, I work 20 miles, you know, 10 miles away, right. Or whatever, 20 miles round trip. I can't do that every day. Eventually my legs, my hips, my, you know, everything is going to start hurting. So I get in the car and I drive to work and no one looks at me like, oh my gosh, he's using a car. What's wrong with him? Right?
Right, right.
it's the same idea.
And the unfortunate thing is people just stop then, right? They're just like, okay, I'm not going to do it. And, you know, it's,
yeah,
that's like the worst thing that you can do, because most of the time it's mobility based, but the, you know, the aspect of, I think you brought something up really, really cogent about no one really cares. And I listened to a really, my wife had been a big Mel Robbins fan. Do you listen to her at all? She's amazing.
No. Okay.
She has this whole concept, like, let them. And it's all this aspect of, like, F other people, right? Who cares?
Sure.
I listened to her. It was on a Scott Galloway podcast, and I'm a big fan of his. But it's sort of that same thing. I was like, at this point, like, who cares what anybody thinks about what you're doing?
Yeah.
Because on one side, they may be there themselves, and then they're going to really feel bad. And on the other side, somebody else might be going, I don't look into that, right? Like, it's super interesting. And I think it all comes down to, like, sort of this decency thing for me, right? And we're talking about sort of individual decisions. But the reason people make individual decisions are because of judgment or whatever. And, you know, especially in the military community and stuff, you're the sheeple and the sheepdog and all that crap. And I look and I think, if you're really a sheepdog, then it's about overall protection, right? It's not mm-hmm. about standing there with a rifle protecting everything. It's about protecting those who can't. And if the disabled community, and I would call that in my definition, again, anybody who can't do a task to the conditions and standards successfully that task is, then guess what? If you're truly a sheepdog, if that's the moniker and what people, then we should all be, and we should all be doing what we can to help the least or the people who are affected and that kind of thing. And I mm-hmm. just wish that there was more understanding about that, because the other part of it is the sheepdog gets old, right? And right. So it's this thing is we're all in it together. We are. As strong as we are, we're pretty breakable. We're pretty fragile things.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's been a very eye-opening thing to me, because I would have counted myself very much in 20 years ago, 10 years ago, maybe even five, in the I'll just deal with it. And mm-hmm. as we were talking about chefs, it was really interesting. There's a chef who I connected with who has Parkinson's. There were some language issues. She's, I think, out of Mexico. But I asked her, I said, what does a chef do when Parkinson's starts to get in the way of using a knife? And she said, stop cooking, or, you know, and I'm like,
right.
Wow. Like that's your profession. She's well, you know, she's well known in the culinary industry. And that really was one of the things where I look and say, when chefs give up, we got to figure out a way to, you know, and this was this run. Again, it was very organic how this came about. And I think where the rally cry for us as an organization came is to say, this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
We are trying to get a lot of our development ideas from the communities that would be best served. And our overall vision is what we'd love to do is find a way, if someone has a great idea and you want to see the group that is second in innovation to my privates when I was in the Army, they were innovative in getting in trouble. But they're also super innovative in, like, hey, here's a great field solution to a problem.
Yeah.
Is the disabled community. They will make things out of pool noodles and PVC and all these things and that are probably marketable, right? But
yeah.
They don't have the means, the relationships, the capital, and the mechanism to do it. So when we're successful with Nulu and we really figure out the right formula, our goal is to say, what else should we be making for you folks, right? And, you know, it could vary, right? Like, there are so many mobility issues with simple solutions with great impact that need to see the light of day that won't until we as a society start saying, well, wait a minute, we got to figure this out. We got to put money and resources to it. And what's right. funny is I'm not even talking about grants. I'm not even talking about the government. I'm saying this is a profitable place that you can sell.
Yeah.
And the other part, frankly, is there is a disability tax. And it's partly, I think, by design. It's partly by structure. By design, I think it's, hey, you know what? It's a niche product. We can charge you more. We're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't love that. Structurally, it's because it's a niche product. It's expensive to produce. And ultimately, we have to charge you this much to stay in business.
Yeah.
Economy of scale works for everything.
Mm-hmm.
So if we start thinking this way, the economy scale will drive down the price on things like this. And hopefully people look and say, well, wait a minute, how am I missing out on a 100 million person market if it's truly that big for upper extremity issues? Lower extremity, I would guarantee it's better. And there is stuff out there that markets well, like all the Tommy Copper stuff, right? Like all of that sells really well, but they sell like in golf and all that kind of stuff. Like we got to get better at sort of a broader brushstroke of that in fixing those things.
Yeah, exactly. And to your point of, you know, how this stuff is marketable and how adaptable the disabled community is, or how innovative the disabled community is. You ever see the tennis balls that they put on the end of walkers?
Yes. Right? Oh, yeah.
I saw those in Walmart, outside of the pharmacy, like hanging up tennis balls for walkers. Like they already have the holes cut in that you just pop it on the end of the thing. So they say sell this stuff now too. And it's like, it makes sense, but
it does. And they probably have the economy scale so that it's not more expensive than the time needed to drill a hole in a tennis ball or do whatever you got to do.
Yeah.
I mean, there's like shoots and, you know, daylight, and hopefully things will happen that way. And I think a lot, the best thing that can happen is a positive impact of the gray tsunami, and the cost of care drives decision-making and investment and design and development to creating somewhere where they don't need as much care. Because again, it's super expensive, right? Like it should be a priority in asset preservation and all the other things, right? All the other things. It's nothing is in a closed system. Everything has impact and action reaction and all that. And I think a lot could be done. And I think it would help the people who need that value, right? They want to be valued through their independence. They want to be valued not by being taken care of, but by being relevant. And if you can make those major impact, then, and you know, we're great with it for disabled vets. I mean, I gotta say, we're almost too good. There's so many nonprofits that are fighting over the same bone to try to help disabled vets. But it's good. But I think it's great, but we got to go beyond that, right? Not every disabled person is a vet, but they all have value in our society.
Absolutely, 100%. Where can people go to find out more about your knives and the types of products that you guys are going to be developing?
The best place would be, if you type in Nulu Knives, you'll find a ton of stuff in a search. I have a link tree. I'm also publishing some stuff on Substack. The Substack stuff isn't specifically about the knife, but a lot of the stuff I'm writing about this community is there, as well as some of the white papers. Actually, the white paper's on my link tree. But if they do a search and find me on LinkedIn, then it's got all of that information. They can go there. Our site, at the time when this comes out, will be up and running. We're expecting our first knives to meet our Kickstarter demand in March. We got caught up in the tariff BS and Chinese New Year, which pushed our delivery of our hard launch out to about April, so they can go to our site about when this comes out, and they will not necessarily, if they're not able to order, they will be able to order like pre-order.
Sure.
So the timing on this should be great. We were thumping on our manufacturer this week at SHOT Show, and they're on board a little more than they were. So those are the best ways. Again, I'm on all social. I do have a little bit of more light YouTube channel. I have done this on many of the podcasts. There is a dad joke that came with this knife that I love and I'm still trying to sell my partners on. So Nulu, right? N-U-L-U. If you put a G on the front and you put an O between the L and the U, you get new Lou, right? Like a water buffalo named Lou. So on my, it should be like a Cape Buffalo. I even immortalized it in ink because this was what changed my life, right? So you can kind of see it.
Yep.
I think it's on my social. But New Louing is my YouTube channel, and I have my kids help me with that. And it's super fun. So what we try and do is show it in action. It's a real visual product. The only way to get it is when you're like, whoa. So there's some videos there. I'm on like Blue Sky. Like I'm trying to get everywhere.
Sure.
So if they look me up now, I will say there's a different Doug Katz that I'm trying to do stuff with. He's in Cleveland, where I'm actually originally from, which is the bizarre part. And he's like a James Beard chef. So that's not the Mead Duck Cats. The Mead Duck Cats is the one in Trout Valley, Illinois. But hopefully, by the time this comes out, I'm trying to do a collaboration with them because it's just too damn good. Uh-huh. Like two Duck Catses who were born in the same city. I think he was born there. Who are both, you know, it would be cool. So it's not that Duck Cats. It's Mead Duck Cats.
Okay. Well, I'll try to put those links in the show notes for folks who want to connect. So hopefully it'll avoid any confusion. I have those links from you anyway. So so that'll do that. And it's great because I think the more people who are aware of this type of technology and they are in the kitchen, now they're using these knives and they're able to do this thing that they haven't been able to do maybe or not easily able to do before, you know, with traditional knives. And they're now able to use this type of knife to be able to enjoy the things that they used to do. Hopefully that flips that switch in their head and says, okay, well, what else did I used to enjoy doing? And what's preventing me from doing that? And how can I get back to doing that type of thing?
Well, and I want to throw one other thing out there because your audience is usually veterans.
Sure.
And I want to say, like, if any have an idea for an adaptive product, non-mechanical, right? Like, mm-hmm. I don't mess with gears. We don't mess with, you know, it's really just thing. I guess you could have a gear if it's actuated or whatever. But
sure.
Come to me. Like, I would love to help people. I was helped. And for vets who want to be entrepreneurs, there are amazing, amazing, amazing resources. Mm. There used to be Bunker Labs. They merged with IVMF, the Institute for Veterans and Military Families, out of Syracuse. They run several accelerators, and specifically for military and mil-spouse. That was critical in my go-to-market. I have an MBA. That was better content. I mean, my MBA was 20 years old. Great content, great place to go. There is Warrior Rising, another phenomenal one. There's Founders Institute, which have military fellowships and scholarships. And there's Dog Tag, which actually, I think they're out of Missouri. I don't know for sure. But you go through their cohort, you actually get a stipend, and then you work in their facility. But your business doesn't have to be like it's a bakery that you work in. But there are all these things out there. And I've been talking a lot about disability, but I also think that the criticality of our country regaining some of what we did, like after World War II, 85% or that some number like that of businesses were owned by veterans.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you look at the 90% failure rate or 99 or 95, whatever the number is, doesn't really matter. That number drops if you've got veterans who have support, who can really bring a thing to market. They got grit. They know how to do stuff. They know how to think. It's like being in the field again.
Yeah.
Let me help you if that's you out there. Or if I'm not the right guy, reach out to these organizations. They're free. They're amazing. And with adaptive products, again, our big picture is let's help other people bring it to market later on after Nulu. So please find me and let me help you because the degree of generosity that has got me to this point it's just been really humbling, right? Like you look and everyone tells you, you've got an idea, don't talk to anybody. F that, talk to as many people as you can.
Yeah.
That's where success will come from. And that's where you will find people to give you agency to open doors. Things like manufacturing. I'm learning a lot of lessons. We had to shit can our first manufacturer because, you know, and that put us a couple of months behind. I don't want other veterans to have those lessons. So we'd love to help.
Well, that's wonderful. And so, again, your details will be in the show notes for the listeners. So check that out if you want to get in touch and if you want to find out more about the knives and maybe that seems like something that's good for you or someone you know, definitely go check it out. And I'll have a link to the website there where you can
either
pre-order or buy one yourself, depending on when you're listening to this and when the sales start going live. But, man, this has been a great conversation. I think,
enjoyed it.
Got the gears turning, I think, a little bit. You know, for me anyways, hopefully for some of the listeners as well.
I'm going to get a call from you. Hey, I got this great idea. Let's build.
I know, right?
Right?
but no, seriously, anyone out there who is, you know, thinking of a product and they have this idea in mind, just don't know, you know, what's that next step? How do I do this? You know, definitely reach out and, you know, to either to Doug or to some of these organizations here. And I'm sure there's a way to do it.
And literally, if you had asked me, It's been about 2 years now, really 1 year with my existing team. Okay. If you had asked me if I would be at this point, I'd have told you you're crazy. Mm-hmm. It's been a mix of Forrest Gump and oh my God, I'm drawing a total. What's the guy, the nuclear bomb guy? The movie last year.
Oppenheimer.
Oppenheimer. Somewhere yeah. between that, right? Where it's been really organic, but I never would have thought. Like, I never would have thought yeah. that ugly thing I built in my garage just because I couldn't do anything would now be, you know, I would have a partner in SHOT Show talking to distributors. But everybody can do that. And veterans yeah. are great at it. So just would love to help them.
Yeah, absolutely. And you go much further when you're going together than you do going alone. So definitely partner up, find people, trustworthy people, and partner up with them and figure out how to make your dreams, your ideas, whatever it is, to go as far as they possibly can. But this has been great. I really do appreciate it. And again, for the listeners, check those links out.
Thank
in the
you
show
so
notes.
Much. I always love a platform to be able to share the fortune and everything that I've had. Mm-hmm. And hopefully yeah. it's provided some value for your viewers.
Yeah, I think so. It's definitely got the gears turning in my head. So hopefully it has in the heads of some of the listeners. So thanks again. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.